This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
As the hadith says about fasting, sufidati shayateen, the shaitans are chained up in the month of Ramadan, and the whole world is going through a kind of ascetical fasting from many of its pleasures and its customary joys at the moment, and as a result the heart is liberated. Where the shayateen are chained, the angels are unchained, and the heart begins to move again. And human beings have an opportunity through stillness and inactivity to reflect on the things that for humanity until the growth of our sort of consumer addictions constituted the most important questions of human life. Just yesterday evening here, we had two Zoom shahadas, which was nice, in close succession. There does seem to be an increase in people's receptivity towards the things of deen and a certain sense of detachment towards the dunya distractions, which have done such harm not just to the state of our souls, but also to the state of the planet and just about every other species that sadly has to share the planet with us. So the hadith in Bukhari and Muslim says, innama sawmu junnah. It's one of the best known kind of khutbah standards when Ramadan begins. Fasting is a junnah, which is a slightly unusual word, and generally it's translated as protection. So let's go with that, a shield. فَإِذَا كَانَ أَحَدُكُمْ صَائِمًا فَلَا يَرْفَثْ وَلَا يَجْهَلْ وَإِنْ شَاتَمَهُ أَحَدٌ أَوْ قَاتَلَهُ فَلْيَقُلْ إِنِّي صَائِمٌ. Who is fasting, let him not speak in an ugly way or behave in an ignorant and coarse way. And if somebody insults him or picks a fight with him, let him just say, I'm fasting. So protection indeed. But this junnah comes from the Arabic word that also gives us words like Majnun, which means crazy, or jinn, who are the unseen ones. It means something that causes a detachment and a move into a different kind of plane. So when we are fasting, we, as it were, are moving into a different air. We breathe differently. It's like that experience we have when we dive underwater. We're still ourselves, but we inhabit a very different ambient environment, and one that we feel is not so naturally geared to the gratification of our cravings and our nourishment. We are in a different space. When we fast, we breathe a different air. So this junnah, this protection that is also something to do with something hidden, has to do with this capital virtue of uzlah. We are taking a step back from the normal kind of monkeyish desire within ourselves immediately to reach for the next source of sense gratification. We simply can't. And one of the blessings that people often remark on during Ramadan is that it actually gives us the good news that we are capable of making a difference and dealing with our addictions. If you can knock off smoking during the day, that's a good start. If you can reduce your food intake during the day, that suggests that you're obesity problem might not be so hopeless as you might think. There's a lot of good news in fasting, in that it shows us that we do have this capacity to exercise will. But this uzla, this i'tizal, a term that comes up quite often in the Quran, which is the necessary human taking of a step back from the entanglement of desires and stuff and the cravings of the lower self, so that the higher self might disentangle itself and learn once again to fly, is something that is not just a matter of human experience, that we decompress when we're away from these distractions and these anxiety-inducing distractions, which are really part and parcel of the modern world. The next text, the next YouTube clip, the next thing. Whenever we show the least sign of being bored, even if we're only 4 years old, we reach for a screen. And this is certainly not what the brain is designed for, and the long-term consequences for the human metabolism are hard to guess, but are unlikely to be good. The consequences for the spirit, quite apart from the consequences for our mental health, are likely to be even more deleterious, because the spirit craves stillness, reflection, ta'ammul, tafakkur. That's when it finds itself. That's when it's at peace. So we find that in the lives of the Anbiya, alayhim wassalam, the prophets cited in the Holy Quran, that just about everyone goes through some kind of episode of stepping back, of seclusion, of uzla. You think of Sayyidina Musa, alayhi salam, who is the kind of archetypal social prophet. He's with his people and arguing with his people and arguing with Fir'aun, and he's in the maqam of kalam. He's Kalimullah, Allah's spokesman. Still has these times when he is going solo, is in the desert, having committed the alleged crime in Egypt. He then, in the culmination of his career, as it were, his mi'raj, he goes to Sinat for the wa'at, the promise of his Lord, where he receives the law, the tablets of the law. And then he goes back, returns to his people, and finds them with the golden calf, and things become harder. Sayyidatina Maryam, in the Qur'an, of course, experiences the extraordinary visitation of Jibril alayhi salam when she is in her state of i'tizal, intibad, in a distant place, makanan qasiyya, a place that is remote, which our tafsir authors usually identify with the desert to the east of Jerusalem, the wilderness. Sayyidina Ibrahim alayhi salam also goes solo after his expulsion from the house of his father, and so on. There is an element of uzla. The beginning of the story of Mecca is a time of isolation and solitude. Sometimes there's two or three of them there. Sayyidina Ibrahim is sometimes there with Ismail and Hajar, but it's a very forlorn and remote experience. We tend to forget that the enormous crowds of the Hajj begin with that solitude. And Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam begins his risala, his message, in the cave of Hira, at the Mount of Light, where the same angel comes to him and in this terrifying way orders him to recite Iqra, which is the first word of Allah's uncreated speech to emerge into this strange paradoxical world of space and time. So a lot of seclusion. And in our civilization, the merit of seclusion has often been debated. If the prophets, alayhim wassalam, are sometimes alone and seem to be very spiritually close to their Lord at that time, the angel doesn't turn up when there's a crowd by and large, but when the chosen one is alone, we have also recognized that there has to be this balance. So the prophets balance being with people, often arguing against them, trying to help them, but also times of solitude and seclusion. And in the forms of Islam, there are also types of stepping back, self-prohibition. Even the Hajj, which is this enormous example of sohba and companionship, is also a time when we are detached in certain ways from certain pleasures through the rules of ihram, which are actually quite strenuous rules and which forbid to us certain things, which even when we're fasting in Ramadan, we are allowed to do. It is a sacred state of tajreed, of stripping away of dunya attachments. And Ramadan is another example of that. And the prayer itself, when we pray, we're really not allowed to indulge any of our usual pleasures. We can't even answer the phone. We're also in the state of seclusion, but as they say, khalwa fil jalwa, solitude in the crowd. And this is a virtue that the spiritual of this community have always commended. In other words, don't osmotically be absorbed by the impulses of the people who are in the shopping mall. Try and remember your Lord. Go in for what you want to buy. Go out again, but don't get caught up in that kind of mass comatose attitude, the hypnosis that the advertising men have imposed on otherwise quite coherent human beings, that we're supposed to be better than that. So, yeah, Junna, a protection and a stepping back. Now, one of the big questions, I suppose, in the history of Islamic education, you might say, but also of the Muslim mapping of what it means to turn away from stuff and the misery that usually entails and the agitation of the soul towards the author, the creator of the stuff, which is Deen itself, which is Tawbah, has been the question of the role of fitra and intellect and the heart and what you might call a kind of natural theology. To what extent can we do this? Is it in our fitra? Is this determination to turn towards the light something that is very strong in us and dunya has difficulty in suppressing, except for our age when dunya is almost all that is ever talked about and is in our lungs, we find it hard to escape it. And one of the debates in our civilization, and many of the ulama, including Imam Ghazali and Abdul Ghani Nablusi, whose book on solitude we might look at, is somebody called Ibn Tufayl, who dies in 1085, and he's from Al-Andalus. He spends his life there, although he dies in Morocco. He's from Wadi Ash, which is a town just to the north of Granada, so in southern Al-Andalus, and has a career really identified generally as a kind of philosophical person. So Ibn Rushd is his star pupil in many ways, and it's Ibn Tufayl who seems to have suggested to Ibn Rushd that he writes his momentously world-changing commentaries on Aristotle, which then go into Latin and trigger the scholastic revolution, and is, of course, revered by Thomas Aquinas and the medieval church, and one of the strands that's led into the subsequent trajectory of human thought. But Ibn Tufayl doesn't write big philosophical books, but what he's mainly remembered for is one of the strangest books in Islamic civilization. But again, one that has had an enormous sort of radiant power beyond the frontiers of the Ummah, which is his little book called Hayy bin Yaqzan, Alive Son of Awake. That's already a kind of strange thing to call a book. It sounds as odd in Arabic as it does in English. And what Ibn Tufayl is talking about in the form of this parable, this mathal, and it's a kind of Sufi story insofar as it seeks to talk about something that's sort of theosophically really important by using a quite simple story, although it's in prose, not poetry, is the story of the castaway. Hayy bin Yaqzan, alive son of awake, is supposedly a baby abandoned as a castaway on a desert island off the coast of India. And the child becomes a kind of feral child, I suppose we might say, and is adopted by a doe, a female deer, who feeds him and is able to grow to childhood, and then the female deer dies. During the course of Hayy bin Yaqzan's completely unlettered childhood, he looks around. There's no dunya distraction, there's no Walmart, there's no Asda, there's no Radio 4, there's nothing except virgin nature and himself and the wide heavens above. And Ibn Tufayl is using this as a kind of thought experiment to indicate what are we capable of in a state of complete seclusion if we've never seen another human being but are simply surrounded by fitra, by the glories of virgin nature. And in this story, Hayy bin Yaqzan, who is of a pneumatic or a spiritually able capacity, is able to infer certain things from the world which indicate what we would call the existence of the Creator. So looking at the way in which everything in his island has a cause, and realizing that there cannot be an infinite regress, an endless succession, a tasalsul of physical causes, but there must be something that has set that causal chain into motion. He concludes that there must be a musabbib al-asbab, a cause of causes which cannot itself be physical, but must be uncaused. And therefore he arrives at the idea of the creator. Without ever going to madrasa or reading a book, he comes to this conclusion. Similarly, the existence of the spirit, of some kind of animating force, which he finds by looking inside himself and by considering what happens on the tragic day when his kind of animal stepmother, the doe, dies, and there she is, but she's not there. That great existential shock that makes us realize the importance of the animating spirit. And also looking at the order of the world, the beauty of the world, the balance of the world, and concluding that one needs to have a spiritual life and devote oneself in adoration to the source of that life. So in his Osler, his absolute solitude, alive son of awake, on his desert island, addresses himself to the Lord of Heaven. And he devises for himself, and this is particularly interesting, certain rituals. Because this realization that we have, this surging up of a yearning for our origin and our place of return and our creator, which is what the heart starts to feel when it's just no longer distracted by the dross of dunya, needs to express itself formally. And this is a basic human need. We really need ritual, and we've needed ritual since Stonehenge and before Stonehenge. It's part of the human experience. So a live son of awake looks at the stars of the sky and the heavenly bodies and sees their purity. It's impossible to imagine the moon being contaminated. And therefore those higher things being clean suggest that in order to become higher, we human beings also need to clean ourselves. So without ever reading a book of fiqh, he comes up with something that looks a bit like the rituals of wudu as an appropriate preparation for the act of surrender and loving submission to the creator. He then sees that the creation itself, which is in really a very Quranic way, engaged in a state of cosmic witnessing to the glory and the beauty and the perfection of its source, operates cyclically. There are seasons, the sun and the moon rise and they set, human life and other lives come and they go, everything is cyclical. And therefore he assumes that the human form of an appropriate divine worship must also be cyclical. So he starts walking around his little hut where he prays and finds this circularity, this kind of tawaf, a very effective way of joining the cosmic sympathy. So in his worship, he finds kind of cycles that might perhaps in Ibn Tufayl's mind have looked a bit like the rak'ahs and so on. And so the point, the moral of the story is that he gets Islam without ever reading a word or having heard the speech of a prophet or coming into contact with any of the creator's books, but he is a fitri human being in a state of what you might call creation spirituality. And then the story changes. Somebody else is washed up on this island, somebody called Absal, and is from another island. And first of all, he breaks in upon a live son of awake when he, in his Osler, his lockdown, as it were, is completely, ecstatically, blissfully transformed by his worship of the divine. Absal comes along, another human being. And this is disruptive. Something new, something has disturbed this pattern, this odd biped who Hai realizes is another human being, has appeared. And he's really angry because he's been taken out of this state of blissful contemplation of the higher verities. And a kind of disagreement ensues, but eventually they find ways of communicating. And Absal tells Hai of his own island and how the people have fallen away from a state of harmonious dealing with their creator and with creation, and are in a state of uproar, anxiety, materialism, desire for status and things. And then Hai learns another lesson, which is really the lesson of compassion. If you recognize Allah's beauty in everything in the world, which is something that is enabled by the stillness which seclusion gives us, and assume a gratitude for them, and you see the mercy of the compassionate God and the principle of beauty in the world, superabundant everywhere, you yourself wish to become a beautiful person, and therefore a compassionate person. You can't just sit idly by while others are suffering. That's not part of perfection. It's not one of the consequences, the fruits of worship. And so a live son of awake goes with Absal off to his island to try and preach to these miscreants, these kind of rather modern sounding people. And it doesn't go too well because they can't hear it. They haven't had that inward state of limpid tranquility that enables them to see that, well, this makes a lot of sense. And of course, we'd love to worship. And of course, there is a source, a one source behind everything. They're busy with stuff and status, and it's a bit like, you know, the response that prophets tend to receive. They're always strangers in their own country. So he returns with Absal, and they spend the rest of their days, according to the story, in a state of worship and single-hearted dedication to the divine. Now, this is a big story, and one of the things that I want to do in these lectures is to track the trajectory of some of these Muslim ideas, these memes, as we might say, nowadays, in crossing borders and influencing Europe and the West for the best. And in this case, this book, this little Arabic book, Hayy ibn Yaqzan, gets translated into European languages. And this is done, first of all, by Edward Pocock, who's a professor of Arabic in Oxford in the 17th century. And that's done into Latin. And then somebody called William Ockley, who's our Sir Thomas Adams Professor of Arabic in Cambridge shortly afterwards, is done into English. And the book then really becomes a kind of 17th, 18th century literary sensation. Everybody is reading A Live Son of Awake. Philosophicus autodidactitus, or whatever it is in Latin, the self-taught philosopher, the one who's got to the summum bonum, has understood everything by being taught on his own. And it becomes, in the context of the rise of Platonism in Europe, and also a certain sense of dissatisfaction with certainly church Christianity, one of the go-to texts. So it's very influential in the formation of the Quaker movement in England, for instance, and with some of the original nonconformist movements. And it goes on to influence, well, one example that's frequently cited is Kant, who seems to have read it. A number of other philosophers. And also, interestingly, it's almost certainly the inspiration for Daniel Defoe's novel Robinson Crusoe, famously the first novel in the English language. Defoe seems to have read the translation, and the story is very similar, although Defoe doesn't really get the kind of spiritual dimension of it, but it becomes a kind of adventure story. Although it does have an esoteric dimension that modern readers generally don't get because they don't inhabit that world with its assumptions and vocabulary. So this becomes a bestseller in the Western world, particularly in the English-speaking world, and triggers, or is one of the factors that triggers, one of what I call the three waves of love. That sounds a very soppy expression. Sounds like the title of a Catherine Cookson novel, perhaps. But I mean love in the sense of sacramental, sacred love. In other words, recognizing the lovability of things because they are bear witness to the beauty and the wisdom of their transcendent creator. So real love, what they call ishq haqiqi. In our vocabulary, we tend to differentiate between real love and metaphorical love. Real love is the love of the one who owes everything to its source. And metaphorical love is the love that we experience when we love something or someone, because in that person there are unmistakable signs of the beauty and the greatness of the creator. So there's a kind of mirroring. So we have this in our Islamic culture, which is in a sense Quranic. Ibn Yaqzan comes from the Islamic world. It couldn't really have been created very easily in Western, certainly Latin, Christendom. And where it appears in the West, the story of Alive, Son of Awake, with its idea of a seclusion that leads to a kind of compassion and also a direct knowledge of God. Sometimes it's in sort of deistic circles, people who are trying to sidetrack organized religion, but it's a sacred story. It's certainly not part of the secularization of the West, far from it. It's emphasizing a creation spirituality. Everything in the world breathes the fragrance of its divine source. And what I mean then by these three waves of love is that Islamic civilization has influenced and shaped the West in very many ways. And one of the things that we like to reflect on at the Cambridge Muslim College is not the kind of them and us view of Islam and the West as an endless kind of zero-sum game, but as a dialogue in which Islamic civilization has quite frequently played a catalytic and transformative role. But very often when we think about the medieval Islamic influence on the West, we tend to think of, oh, inventions. Harun al-Rashid sends a nice water clock to Charlemagne, and we have thousands of inventions, and therefore the West really should respect us more and be less Islamophobic because we've had so many inventions and we've contributed to the wonderful march of science and technology, which has now given us, well, a failing world, but never mind. That kind of apologetic Muslim inferiority complex that anxiously wants to prove that Islam really was on the same track towards science, technology, and all of those other wonders. That's not really what revelation is gifting us with. But certainly somebody like Ibn Rushd massively changes the history of philosophy in the West and moves the West away from Plato towards Aristotle in the form of Aquinas and subsequent thinkers. And the Renaissance, of course, is deeply shaped by people like Marsilio Ficino, Pico della Mirandola, and others who are not just reading Islamic philosophical sources, but are also very influenced by the example of the Ottomans, this society that actually allows different religions to coexist. So John Locke was very interested in what he calls the turbaned nations. And one of the foundations of the English tradition of toleration of different religious movements is said to be John Locke's letter concerning toleration, which is almost certainly influenced by his understanding that in the Ottoman example, you have a very successful, powerful Levantine civilization that does allow different religions to exist and to coexist, and therefore, why can't we do that in England? And at the time of the Civil War, that was quite a revolutionary and for many people quite inspiring thought. So there's been a lot of things in political theory, in metaphysics, in ethics, where Islamic civilization has influenced the West. But in terms of the principle of what we would call mahabba, of love, this is less frequently reflected upon. And that's one of the things that I want to, if not really prove academically, at least indicate. Ma baraya vasal amadim, na baraya fasal. The Sufis of Persia say, we've come in order to arrive, not in order to differentiate logically. So this is just an indication, an ishara, not an ibara, if you prefer Arabic. But the three waves of love are as follows. Not only has Islamic civilization influenced the intellectual, ethical, political evolution of the West, but also Islamic civilization has rectified certain, perhaps fatal, shortcomings in the spirituality of the West. Now, spirituality is a much more vague thing to theorize and to prove and to trace origins for than something like philosophy. You can see where Al-Ghazali and Farabi and Ibn Rushd change Aquinas, and you can write your PhD thesis on that, and it's quite measurable. But something like a spiritual transformation, something like the quintessential spiritual virtue of mahabba or love, that thing which Ibn Yaqzan discovers without access to written revelation, that's going to be harder to map. But in any case, what I'm proposing is that there have been three great episodes, three waves, in which the principle of mahabba in our civilization, which is absolutely essential and part of Iman itself. The Quran says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَشَدُّ حُبًّا لِلَّهِ. Those who have Iman have more love for Allah. And this wonderful Quranic evocation of the complexity and beauty and perfection and order of the created world, خَلْقِ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, all of that, which necessarily inspires love. There can be no recognition of beauty that doesn't also engender love. Love is the recognition of perfection, or the detection of perfection in something. That this love-based Quranic insistence on the divine immanence and presence in the world with his simultaneous transcendence is something that was harder in Western theologies and philosophies, and something which the West, whenever it could open a channel, hoovered up very thirstily from the Islamic world. So wave number one, Al-Hubb al-Udhri. If you've listened to my little Paradigms of Leadership lecture about Sukaina bint al-Husayn, Imam al-Husayn's daughter, you'll find that I reflect quite a lot on the nature of the literature that accompanied primal Islam. And it's a literature of love. The great era of love poetry in Islamic civilization, often quite frank and explicit even, is that of the early believers and the Ahlul Bayt and those who are closest to the Ahlul Bayt. And this principle of mahabba, of affirmation of creation, that comes really from the prophetic embracing of the world. Despite his times of seclusion, he was a man who transformed the world by living in the world and recognizing Allah's signs in the world and the beauty of women and the beauty of love. And this is a major theme of early Islam. Some of the Orientalists were always a bit perplexed by this, and they thought, oh, this is a reaction against the severe world-denying asceticism of early Islam. But no, it isn't. These were very devout people who were sharing that literature. So we have the Layla Majnun legend, Jamil Buthayna, Wamiq Azra later on, these great love stories that become very easily turned into allegories of the human love for the lost divine beloved. And this tradition of love poetry in Islamic civilization, shared by the ulama as much as by everybody else, which is part of Islam's creation spirituality and love of Allah's signs in the world, goes viral and crosses over, crosses the frontier, sudden 10th, 11th, 12th century efflorescence of this idea of courtly love, chaste love, by and large, the praising of the qualities and the beauty of the beloved becomes a kind of craze in Europe at that time and replaces the rather ascetical and difficult poetry that precedes it. And there are speculations that the word troubadour might actually come etymologically from the Arabic word tarab, which means kind of joy, which is the word for singing, the context in which this kind of amatory verse, which is popular in Muslim Spain, found its way into Europe. And the idea of strophic verse, rhymed poetry, coming into Europe from the Muslim world, because the Romans didn't have rhymed poetry. That influence, along with so many other influences that we got in England, stay indicative for one to find kind of one's own religion by experiencing with an open heart and distance, seclusion from dunya, that reality. And this becomes a major theme in Europe and one of the key factors in the Enlightenment, and particularly the counter-Enlightenment and the age of Romanticism. So Jeff Einbodden, in his book on Islam and Romanticism, Rumi and others, on the transformation of European literature and European sensibilities in the 18th and the 19th century. And of course, Goethe is the key example of this with his famous Mohammed's Gesang, his song about the blessed prophet as somebody who is an affirmer of nature and a builder of civilization, but his Westdeutsche Divan and the whole transformation of German, but also English literature at that time, comes clearly from that second wave of the penetration of literature from the East. This time it's not the Leila Majnun legend, Jamil Buthayna, and so forth. The Arabic poetry tends to come through the Persians, the translation of great Persian poets, Sa'di, Rumi, Hafez, into Latin, German, English, French, triggers this huge transformation. So this is something that, of course, made Europe the case, that the great paradigms of romantic literature in Europe, the rediscovery of love, comes from the Islamic world. So that's wave number two. Where's the third? Well, the third is happening also kind of without the Ummah particularly intending it, but just through the power of the principle, in what you might call the Rumi phenomenon, particularly in the United States, but also across Europe, that Rumi, even though Trump has brought in the Muslim ban and Rumi's Afghan compatriots aren't allowed into America now, but it's harder to keep these memes out. And particularly this Rah-i-Ishq, this way of love, is irresistible. And Franklin Lewis, in his book Rumi, Past and Present, East and West, has this hundreds and hundreds of pages explaining how profound has been the transformation of Western sensibilities by this supreme, history's supreme poet of divine love. A nature mystic, but also one who is absolutely overwhelmed by the love of God. And that story, of course, is ongoing. One might remark, as a rather sad footnote to that, the fact that the Ummah is not taking advantage of this. The Ummah is more interested in, ooh, Muslims invented water clocks, or, ooh, Muslims brought sugar to Western Europe, and look, we contributed to your progress, rather than to see what might be authentically and indigenously spiritual. Generally, our discourse in the West is based on, can we have niqab in the school, please, and can we have halal meat in the prisons, and can you stop being Islamophobic and shut those people up? And it's a grievance culture, because we're insecure, and because we no longer are inhabiting that space, the Quranic space of tafakkur, thinking about the beauty of the heavens and the earth, this wonderful, upbeat, celebratory, Quranic insistence that everything is staggering and everything is praising God's name, and we just need to join in the most beautiful religious vision that there's ever been, incredibly upbeat and absolutely focused on this principle of وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَشَدُّ حُبَّ لِلَّهِ, those who have iman have more love for Allah. But we're not in that space, unfortunately. When we go into the interfaith gathering, we say, well, here's a translation of some text on Aqidah, but this wave of love, we're not surfing on that wave of love, unfortunately, but it's happening anyway. That is a meme that they can't get out, because what is more delicious, and what do human beings most crave? So that's my theory of the three waves of love. But let's rewind a little bit before we sign off, because people are going to, depending on where they are, want to think about the iftar. You'll have noticed that there is a connection between this Islamic idea of seclusion, of uzla, or khalwa, if you like, i'tikaf, but also the contemplation of nature. And you might think, well, if the mystic is in his cell, how's he going to get out and take a hike and experience the beauties of nature? Well, actually, our stories where we talk about solitude and transformation and joyful upliftment are not stories of the monk in his cell or in his cave, which is more a kind of Christian or Buddhist monastic tradition, but are actually about being alone in nature. And that's the case with those Quranic stories, Sayyidina Ibrahim, Sayyidina Musa, Sayyidina Muhammad, they're out seeing the glory of nature. If you've been to that cave on the Mountain of Light, you'll see it has the greatest view in the world. You see the world and the rising and the setting of the sun and the moon and the celestial bodies. It's staggering. The beauty of it is an overwhelming sign. That our seclusion tends to be a seclusion which is open to the beauty of nature. Think about Imam al-Ghazali, for instance, Rahmatullahi Alayhi. His seclusion, this drastic crisis that he had, and his 10 years disappearing and turning down so many opportunities for dunya and academic preferment, and just almost barefoot going off into the desert,
He is traveling. The Islamic tradition of holy seclusion is more to do with siyaha than tarahub. In other words, it's a holy traveling, the idea of the dervish who's not just sitting in a cave, but is out there wandering around, celebrating the beauty of the world, doing compassionate things, working miracles. It's one of the great tropes of our civilization, the wandering solitary. The hermit who is kind of a friar, if you like, he's out and about engaging with society. And that, I think, is what differentiates us from the Buddhist and the early Christian idea of solitude and renunciation of the world. Because in those contexts, it's also about renunciation of nature. It's about a dualism that we have to mortify the flesh and turn ourselves into almost skeletons. If you look at some of those Buddhist images of the fasting Buddha, it's quite, it's like something out of a concentration camp. And we have to do that so that the body and the flesh and our enjoyment is no more. And then the spirit will be liberated. Now, in early Christianity, there were a lot of debates as to exactly what you do with the world. But it was noted that Jesus and his disciples were kind of solitaries, not engaged in large networks of family life. St. Paul similarly, and if you read Peter Brown and his book The Body and Society, you'll read hundreds of pages of actually profoundly depressing stories of mortification and people who tortured themselves, the vows of monasticism, poverty, chastity, obedience, and the endless flagellant stories of certain forms of Christianity that were normal at that time. And one of the reasons for the need for a rectification of the spirituality of the world that made the rise of Islam inevitable was the fact that that had become too dismal. So one of the arguments in contemporary Christianity is we need to get back to a nature spirituality, and we need to start celebrating rather than flagellating. So here is the work of a former Catholic priest, really a bestseller. I wouldn't recommend all of it, but it is at least indicative of where this argument is leading. This is Matthew Fox, Creation Spirituality. So he's talking about the crisis of spirituality in the West and the way in which this flagellant monastic type of Christianity is not really functioning as a very attractive alternative, particularly to young people. So this is what he says in his introduction. What religion must let go of in the West is an exclusively fall redemption model of spirituality, a model that has dominated theology, Bible studies, seminary and novitiate training, hagiography, psychology for centuries. It is a dualistic model. It begins its theology with sin and original sin and generally ends with redemption. Fall redemption spirituality does not teach believers about the new creation or creativity, about justice-making and social transformation, or about eros, play, pleasure, and the God of delight. It fails to teach love of the earth or care for the cosmos, and it is so frightened of passion that it fails to listen to the impassioned pleas of the anawim, the little ones of human history. This same fear of passion prevents it from helping lovers to celebrate their experiences as spiritual and mystical. Well, you can see where he's coming from. He's in California and he's coming out of the 60s and the 70s, the hippie generation, the turn to green spiritualities, but is also coming from a Catholic monastic background. And he's saying we need to get rid of those doctrines of the wrong kind of seclusion, the doctrines that say that nature is just fallen, and that humanity without grace is a massa damnata, and back to something more cheerful. So essentially, the distinction that I'm trying to make here is that these three waves of love were welcomed by Europe because so many people were fatigued by an insistence that you could only turn to your creator if you turned away from the wonder and the beauty of the world. And you had to, if you were serious, go into some kind of monastic training and perhaps quite drastic strategies of self-denial, celibacy and poverty and the rest. This is not the way of Islam. The Holy Prophet says, La rahbaniyata fil Islam. There is no monasticism in Islam. He comes from the Mountain of Light and enters his society. Sometimes he's in i'tikaf.
sometimes he is with his Lord, but he is also with his people. Imam al-Haddad says, وَقْطَعِ الْحُجُبَ الْكَثِيفَةَ بِالسَّيْرِ عَنْهَا وَقْطَعِ الْحُجُبَ اللَّطِيفَ بِالسَّيْرِ فِيهَا. Cut through the thick veils by going around them, cut through the subtle veils by going through them. What he means by the thick veils is kind of the deadly sins. You don't deal with them by participating in them until you come out the other side. I gratify this pleasure and then I'll be all right. No, you avoid them. But the thin veils, which is kind of the distractions of this world, you engage with them and you don't run away from them, which is why our normalcy in our civilization is sohba and not uzla. It is sociality and not solitude, even though sometimes solitude can have that extraordinary spiritual effect. Let me just read a hadith which is particularly moving, and perhaps we can call an end to this shortly. Qala ibn Umar. Ibn Umar said, tell us about the most remarkable thing you have seen from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Aisha wept and said, every aspect of him was remarkable. Once he approached me on my allotted night until his skin touched my skin. Then he said, let me pray to my Lord. He went to the water skin, performed his wudu from it and stood up to pray. But then he wept so much that he wet his beard. Then he went into prostration so that he wet the floor. Then he lay down on his side until Bilal came to call to the morning prayer. And Bilal asked, Ya Rasulullah, a messenger of God, what has made you weep? When Allah has forgiven you your past errors and the future ones. He replied, Wayhaka ya Bilal, woe unto you, O Bilal. What could stop me weeping when Allah the Exalted has sent down to me this night, Inna fi khalqi samawati wal ard, wa ikhtilafi al-layli wan nahar, la ayatin li ulil albab. There are in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the variations of night and day signs to those with receptive hearts. Then he said, woe to him who reads it and fails to contemplate on it. So the Holy Prophet in this night is just overwhelmed by this divine revelation that in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the succession of night and day and the majesty of creation are the things that fill us with a sense of meaning and of longing and of nostalgia. The beauty of Fajr time, the beauty of the sunset, the wonders of creation, signs for people of understanding. These are not signs to be run away from, locking the door of the monastery or the cell behind you. No, we are in creation, we are part of creation, we are to join the cosmic symphony of cosmic praise. And that is, just to sum up, what I believe to be the distinction between Islamic and some earlier religious visions of seclusion. Ours is a seclusion that is in nature and that affirms nature, and our forms of worship and our ibadah affirm nature, because we know when the sun rises and sets. Our ibadah is absolutely integrated in nature, just as was the ibadah of alive, sun of awake. So it's a seclusion in nature so that we can feast on Allah's signs and help the spirit to be nourished. But that, of course, requires stillness and calmness.